Gehring is back at almost 100%. So we're welcoming him back from his illness, and he's going to do what we had had on the agenda for the first meeting, but he's going to start today. So, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members, and first, I appreciate your flexibility on scheduling as I dealt with what was a pretty stubborn cold over the last week or so. What I'm going to do today is give a very, very brief overview of higher education systems in Minnesota with a focus on generally who has oversight and who's in charge and how they get there. There are a couple of handouts in your packet that you might want to use to follow along with the content of what I'm going to be talking about today. These are the brown handouts. There's one that's titled Governing Higher Education Systems in Minnesota, and then at the very end of my presentation, I'm going to talk about election of the regents at the University of Minnesota. So you can follow along with those two handouts. I'm not going to go exactly in order with the way the content is printed in the handout, but pretty much everything I'm going to be talking about is in these two documents. So there are three primary agencies that I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about the Office of Higher Education, and then the MinSCU system and the University of Minnesota system. I'm going to start with the Office of Higher Education as the state agency. So the Minnesota Office of Higher Education is kind of the primary office in state government that has some oversight over higher education systems in Minnesota. The Office of Higher Education, though it's not technically called a department, it's effectively a cabinet-level position. So the director of the Office of Higher Ed is appointed by the governor. It's based on 2003 change in the law that allows for a governor's appointment. The current director of the office is Larry Pogemiller, the former senator who is now the director of that office. The Office of Higher Education has a couple of basic functions provided in statute. First is that they administer a variety of state financial aid programs and agreements. These types of programs include the self-loan, deal with child care grants, the chief scholarships, Indian scholarships, and a number of other types of state-based grant and scholarship programs. They also have some oversight and administrative authority over federal aid programs that affect students and institutions on a statewide basis. So they're kind of the primary office and contact within the state for a number of different types of financial aid programs and procedures. The Office of Higher Ed also has responsibility for administering the tuition reciprocity programs that the state has with a number of other states. So Minnesota has reciprocity programs with North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Manitoba, and then also one small school in Iowa. In most cases, these programs have existed since the 1960s or 70s, and it's the Office of Higher Ed that sort of deals with these agreements and deals with these procedures. Just recently, the office issued their 2013 report on tuition reciprocity agreements, which has a bunch of data that has been provided to the chair that I can also follow up with any individual members if they're interested. Just over 28,000 Minnesota residents have enrolled in an institution outside of the state of Minnesota based on a reciprocity agreement, and about 16,500 out-of-state residents have enrolled here in Minnesota in a Minnesota-based institution. And all these agreements and procedures go through the Office of Higher Education. A third primary function in addition
to... Mr. Gehring, Representative Poppy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just... Was that 16,000 or 60,500?
16,000.
Thank you.
So there are 28,000 Minnesota residents that are going out of state, and about 16,500 that have come into state from other states. A third primary function of the Office of Higher Ed is to register private institutions. So the state doesn't have direct oversight or sort of control over private post-secondary institutions in Minnesota, but we do require in state law that they be registered. So they register with the Office of Higher Ed. They're required to register if they're a nonprofit and they grant baccalaureate or higher degrees, or if they use the terms academy, college, institute, or university in their names. Some certain types of out-of-state public institutions are also required to register with the Office of Higher Ed if they offer courses or programs within the state. In addition to registration, there are licensing requirements for certain types of for-profit institutions, and this is a growing area in the area of higher ed. There are these sort of for-profit schools that don't necessarily grant degrees but are sort of career schools. So, for example, Globe University or the University of Phoenix are examples of for-profit institutions that offer courses and programs within the state. These institutions are required to be licensed by the Office of Higher Education in order to offer their services within the state. The Office of Higher Education has, as I said earlier, has a director. They also have a couple of advisory councils that meet and provide advice and guidance to the office and its staff. These include the Higher Education Advisory Council and then a Student Advisory Council. The Student Advisory Council has specific membership requirements in the law, and they're required to sort of take a student's perspective and give direction to the office based on sort of student needs. So that's the basic overview of the Office of Higher Ed. Now I'm going to talk about the two primary public systems that you all are certainly already familiar with. The Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system is one of the primary public higher education systems in Minnesota. This is a combination of state universities, community colleges, and technical colleges. The MinSCU system was established as primarily in the 1990s. It was sort of a merger of the state universities and colleges together into one system. The merger was finally completed and implemented in 1995. There are 24 two-year colleges across the state and then 7 four-year degree-granting universities in Marshall, Mankato, Winona, St. Cloud, Moorhead, Bemidji, and St. Paul. Overall, enrollment at all the campuses is just over 200,000 students. About 193,000 students in the MinSCU system are undergraduates, and about 6,000 of them are graduate students. MinSCU is governed by a board of trustees. The board of trustees consists of 15 members. The trustees are appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate. Recommendations for trustees are made by a trustee candidate advisory council. This is a council that has existed since 1991. The members of the advisory council include membership that's appointed by the Senate, as well as some members that are appointed by the Speaker of the House. So there's some sort of indirect role for the House in selecting members of the trustees through this advisory council. State law requires that the trustee membership for the MinSCU system represent all the congressional districts in the state. It must also include 3 current students at a MinSCU campus and one member who must represent labor interests. Students on the Board of Trustees serve two-year terms, and other members of the MinSCU Board of Trustees serve 6-year staggered terms. The second primary public institution in Minnesota, as you all know, is the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has a couple of unique sort of legal features in its structure that make it a little bit different than the MinSCU system. First, the University of Minnesota is what's known as a land-grant university. We could talk for sort of an hour about what exactly a land-grant university means, but basically it's unique status that's been conferred on the university by federal law and requires, as a condition of this status, that the university focus on particular types of missions, including agricultural research, military sciences, and mechanical arts issues. The university obviously has sort of expanded its programs to include other types of missions and interests and research projects in addition to these particular ones that are required by federal law, but sort of the basic requirements of the federal law are that they focus on these areas. The University of Minnesota was originally chartered in 1851, which means that it's a university that predates the statehood of Minnesota. Because of this, they are entitled to a certain degree of autonomy in overseeing their operations and management of the university. So this, again, is a sort of a concept that we could talk for quite a long time about, but the university does have this degree of authority to sort of manage their own affairs on their own without oversight from the legislature in a way that, for example, the MinSCU system doesn't. The University of Minnesota has 5 campuses statewide, including the Twin Cities campus. They also have campuses in Crookston, Duluth, Morris, and Rochester. They have a total enrollment of just under 69,000 students as of fall 2012, and about 43,000 of them are undergraduates. The University of Minnesota is governed by a 12-member Board of Regents. The Board of Regents is elected by the legislature pursuant to the University Charter, the Minnesota Constitution, and some other provisions of state law. The Regents must represent each of the congressional districts in the state, and it also includes 4 at-large positions and then 1 student position. The student must be enrolled in a program at the university at the time of their election. Apart from sort of this geographic requirement, there are no additional requirements in state law for membership on the Board of Regents, so that the legislature is permitted to elect whomever it chooses as long as meeting these geographic and student requirements, although the board itself does have some internal policies that relate to conflicts of interest and prohibitions on certain types of activities by regents, including prohibiting a sitting member of the Board of Regents from filing as a candidate for elective office. So if any of those issues were to arise, those disputes would be resolved within the university itself and doesn't affect the ability of the legislature to choose nominees and elect members of the regents as it so chooses. Regents have staggered six-year terms, and the process is currently underway to fill four of the vacancies, which will be happening this year in 2013. The vacancies will include one district in the one representative from the 5th Congressional District. There will be two at-large positions that will have terms expiring, and then one student position whose term will be expiring as well. As I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, there's this handout here in your packet that gives a little bit more detail on exactly how the regent selection process works, but I'll basically kind of get you up to speed on where things are right now with the current process. The Regent Candidate Advisory Council is a council that is established through state law. First, it was established in 1988. The exact procedures that this council follows has sort of evolved over time, but basically what they do now is they accept nominees and take applications and interview candidates and then recommend a slate of potential region nominees to the legislature for the legislature's consideration. The nominees that are submitted by this advisory council are not binding on the legislature, so you can choose to elect someone else if you would like to do that. But the advisory council goes through a process of screening and evaluating and making recommendations and has been doing so over the past several months and issued their final recommendations on January 15th of this year. So their nominees that they have submitted to the legislature include nine individuals over all of the open positions that will be available. As I said, the legislature can choose to accept these nominees and elect from those candidates, or you can choose in committee to elect someone else. Part of the process that's required by state law to elect a regent is to convene a member of the Joint House and Senate Higher Education Committee to approve nominees and submit them to the full legislature in joint session. So the scheduled meeting will be happening this year on February 26th. You're required by state law to meet before February 28th to do this. All of you as members of the Higher Ed Budget Committee are members of this joint committee, as well as the members of the Senate Higher Ed Committee. You come together to form this one joint committee to review and interview candidates for these region positions. At your February 26th meeting, you interview the candidates and you discuss various criteria that you have for electing a region, and then the committee's work is to produce a slate of nominees that then are forwarded to a joint convention of both the House and the Senate, which will be a night later in March, probably, that the House and Senate will meet together. And
Mr. Gehring, members of the committee, the joint hearing is going to be February 26th, and you will have the opportunity, along with the senators, to ask questions in a more formal setting of the region candidates. I assume you've met with at least one or a dozen. It seems like a dozen, but I'm sure it's not that many. Region candidates. I would encourage you to do one thing I don't expect Mr. Gehring to do. I would go back and look in the packet at the performance of the legislature on who has been nominated and how for regions. In anticipation of what you can expect, either in the joint meeting or on the House floor, everybody here should be aware that it has never been a done deal for anyone. In fact, we've taken them from the audience and from the gallery. So it's almost like a game show. Come on down. You want to be a regent? We'll take you. So I would be very forthright with your questions to regent candidates, even though they may not be a candidate who was passed forward by the advisory council. They could still, under this process, and have, become regents. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, and basically that's the conclusion of the comments I had. I would just add to this additional nominee procedure that if you want to select a different nominee from the ones that were recommended by the advisory council in the joint committee, you're required to have the support of at least two senators and three House members on the joint committee to nominate someone else. But once you get to the floor, that condition doesn't apply. So the whole House and the whole Senate acting together does have the authority to pick someone else. Regardless of whether they're nominated by the advisory council or by the committee itself.
And just as a reminder, on his first presentation, We have requested, and I've met with both caucuses for MinSCU, a presentation on their administrative size when they were three systems and on the current administrative size as being one system, among other things, and you've both seen the list. When we get to the Office of Higher Education established in 2004, that has had a very checkered history. It's been eliminated at least twice by the chair and has been reconstituted. So that office should be presenting us, I'm hopefully, this session with exactly what it's being told to present to us, and you will see a detailed presentation on student debt from that office. So I would encourage you to keep these in the packet and then ask pertinent questions as we move forward. Any questions to Mr. Guerin? Then just one last question. Is there anything in statutory law that requires us to act in any way on funding in higher ed?
Mr. Chair, there are state policies in statute that sort of suggest that the legislature intends to provide a certain level of appropriation to the higher ed systems. It's not really mandatory. It's more sort of in the nature of a purpose statement. There have been in the past provisions of statute that do set certain percentages that the state intends to provide to the higher education systems. Some of those were repealed, so they're not, as I said, they're not mandatory, but they're sort of the intention of the legislature and the intention of the law that the state provide. I think the number is 67% of the total cost of instruction.
Say that a little louder.
There's a provision of state law that sets as a policy for the legislature an intention to fund 67% of the total cost of instruction for higher education in Minnesota.
And members, just as a quiz question, approximately what percentage are we now funding the University of Minnesota? They've given us the number. Mr. Gehring, do you happen to know right offhand? I see Mr. Fitzenreiter in back of us, but...
Mr. Chair, the number is in my binder up there.
It's significantly less than 67%, and I think my rough memory, Mr. Fitzenreiter is back there, too. He can present that to us when he comes forward, but it is not 67%. It is a far cry from 67. Representative Grunhagen, you have a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Matt. As far as this governance structure, how do we compare as far as cost and governing structure to other similar institutions? I mean, is there any way of, some of the dates you were given, like in the early 90s, how do they keep this updated, with changes, if there's possible changes to run it more effectively and efficiently?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, I guess that's probably a question that's better directed to Mr. Fitzenreiter and the representatives of the campuses themselves. This document doesn't really deal with the administrative costs of governance. This is just sort of laying out kind of who's in charge and how they get there.
And Representative Grunhagen, when we met earlier and as we were going through that general outline, I'm hopeful that we can develop a statutory requirement to address your concerns so that in the future we would have that as an ongoing automatic presentation of both systems. So, and I'm hopeful that the systems and anyone involved in higher ed will help us craft that, including the legislative auditor. So it will be a document that will be easily understood, and we should be able to use it from session to session. Any other questions of Mr. Gehring? Oh, I'm sorry, is there one more? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gehring, is there a job description then or list of responsibilities for the regents? Talk a lot about process and how they're selected and so forth. Where do I see what it is they're supposed to do?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there isn't in statute a list of conditions or job duties of the Board of Regents. They do have on their website a list of sort of expectations that the regents themselves sort of adopt for themselves, and I could get you a copy of that if you want. But the advisory council that's required to come up with nominees is required to consider things like experience and geographic diversity and racial diversity and gender diversity and a number of other issues, but they're not specific to like job duties or job obligations. As I said, if you want, I can get you the copy of the sort of job description that the job duties that the regents have adopted for themselves, if that would be helpful, but there's nothing in statute that specifies that directly.
Mr. Gehring, Representative Johnson, there is on the House and Senate website a link to the Advisory Council and its hearings. those that are recorded, you can listen to the audio, and you can also listen to the presentations of the region candidates, and some of your question would be answered in those presentations, but the overall would be no.
And Mr. Chair, I would also add that the applications that people have submitted, some portions of the applications are not public data, but there are portions of the applications that are public that you could request from the council itself to see kind of what the qualifications are of each of the applicants, or you could obviously ask them directly in the committee meeting, but you can get some background information of each of the candidates based on what they submitted to the council as well. So if you want that, I could help sort of facilitate getting that information to you.
And members, I encourage you to, when you meet with the candidates, the obvious function of the regions would be oversight of the university. You may want to ask them, if they are a current regent, how they have participated in that oversight, and if they want to be a regent, how they are going to have oversight of the university. Those certainly have been unanswered up to this point. Any other questions of Mr. Gehring? No? Mr. Gehring, thank you. We'll bring the university back up. And members, I've got in my notes page 18, slides 35 and 36 is where I have my last markings. Mr. Fitzenreiter, what's the percentage of state funding for the university at this point in time?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if the question is what percent of our revenues come from state appropriations, it's approximately 18% of our total revenues. That's a different question than someone saying what share of state funding supports instruction. Remember, we have three missions. As I've mentioned to the committee before, if the time allows later, we've done a fully allocated cost of our mission and can show you what both the direct and indirect expenses fully loaded for our mission activities. And if you do that, just as a preview, and again, this is cost accounting that we did to come up with these numbers, but of instruction, the state money would be approximately 14% of the cost of instruction.
All right. Mr. Fitzenreiter, why don't you proceed, or is it Ms. Tonneson who was going next? I'm not sure the screens are on for whatever reason.
They were before.
Which one are you on?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did have it up when we came in the room, and then a house research person came and set up and
hit some buttons
and lost it.
There we go.
We're ready.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we left off on page slide 36. And what we hope to get through today, well, I'll dispense with this one and then introduce sort of the topics to come. This slide simply shows you a trend in our state appropriation, our recurring state appropriation. You can see that today our appropriation from the state for fiscal 13, roughly $570 million, is roughly equivalent to the level of funding we had back in the 98-99 time period. And as you can see, our appropriation has been on a roller coaster during this time period, really reflective of the recessions that the country, the state of Minnesota and the country has had. Higher ed does take a downturn during the bad times, as most of state government does. And we did peak in our appropriation at $708 million back in about 2008, and we've plummeted down to the $570 million today. What we'd like to transition into now, Mr. Chairman and members, is what remains in the original slideshow. See how far we get today. We want to cover now some discussion of tuition and fees, answer again some of the questions the chairman of the committee provided us earlier. We will move then in with my colleague Lincoln Carlson to talk about a cost definition and benchmarking exercise that the university did this recently with the Board of Regents and for the president. We'll move then into, if time allows today, although the pace we've been moving at, we'll probably get to this on Wednesday, is an overview of our debt structure and our capital planning process, and then conclude hopefully on Wednesday with a discussion of our year-end carry forwards, or what we refer to as unexpended funds. So with that, I'll turn to my colleague Julie Tennyson to take us through, and again we'll be handing off here and again interrupt for questions. We are, from previous discussions, making a list of all your questions that we don't answer, and we'll be following up specifically in writing with those answers. So, Julie.
Ms. Tuns.
Mr. Chair, members, that we were asked to...
Ms. Tuns, why don't you just identify yourself for the record, please? Sure. We start over each day.
Sure. Julie Tennyson, Associate Vice President for Budget and Finance and Budget Director at the university. We were asked to provide information on tuition and state appropriations from 2006 or FY06 through FY12. So the next two slides display some information as requested. The blue on this particular slide is the tuition revenue. You can see the revenue is the top line of numbers, 06 through 12. And then there is followed below that with the change in dollars and then in percents. And I would just like to point out that this is revenue, not rate. This is not the percentage increase in the tuition rate charged to students. This is the percentage change from the prior year in the revenue generator, the revenue received by the university. And then in the green is the state appropriation numbers, again, from 06 through FY12. And you can see, again, the dollar change and the percent change in those appropriations. I will mention the tuition revenue itself is actually derived from a combination of things, but one is the rate increase charged to students, and the second is enrollment numbers. Obviously, if we don't change the tuition rate and we have more students, it will generate more revenue. There's also the actually course-taking behaviors of students that will also impact the tuition revenue number. So I just want to point out it's not all rate. You can see from this slide that the increase in the revenue in tuition is highest in the 09, 10, 11 time frame. That does correspond to when we entered this most recent phase or cycle of reductions in our appropriation. You can see that following below in 10 and 11 and 12 particularly. And I do want to mention we were asked for, on the next slide, we were asked for a breakdown of the tuition revenue between undergraduate and then graduate and professional. So on this slide 38, the top is just a repeat of what was on the previous slide, but then you see below that the undergraduate revenue generated and then the graduate and professional. Generally speaking, undergraduate revenue makes up 62-63% of our total tuition revenue, with graduate and professional then making up the other 37 or 38%. And I will say too that as I mentioned earlier, it's a combination of rate and enrollment. If you look at the graduate revenue itself, that is pretty much all rate driven, because the graduate enrollment has been steady, if not dropping a little bit in some cases. On the undergraduate side in this time frame, about 17% of the revenue is driven by enrollment, and the other 83% by the rate.
Ms. Tennyson, Representative Winkler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tennyson, way back in your slide number 7, you show 5,000 freshman enrollees, as it's pretty flat throughout this time period. Can you give us information about what the actual undergraduate enrollment increases have been during this 2006 to 2012 time period, just in numbers of students?
Ms. Tennyson?
Total undergraduate enrollment, I'm not sure if we have that in the backups, do we? We can get it for you for sure. We do have some backup slides here, so we'll check to see if it is there. I don't have that off the top of my head. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Tonneson, I just am curious, you know, looking back at your slide 7, as I read that slide, it looks like you take in about 5,000 freshmen a year, and you always sort of do that?
Correct.
That's at the Twin Cities campus, but I did some other calculations based on other slides, and it looks like about half of your total student enrollment are undergraduates at the Twin Cities campus. So that's going to have a much more weighted impact on the total number of enrollees. So I wonder if you can, without giving numbers, just give a sense of, you know, if you're having students enrolled for a much longer period of time, so therefore the freshman number doesn't tell us much, or if other campuses are expanding and the Twin Cities campus is staying flat. Do you have any sense of it without being tied down to numbers?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lincoln Carlson, Director of Financial Research at the university. I can give you a flavor. So system-wide, I'm sorry, I've got from 2007 to 11, but it's indicative. Fall 2007, system-wide undergraduate, 40,572, increasing to 44,071 total enrollment. A few things buried within that number. Certainly our system campuses during this time period have grown. Morris, Crookston, and Duluth have all increased in number of undergraduates over that time period to various extent. We opened our University of Minnesota Rochester campus, and they had their first freshman class, I believe, in 2010, fall 9 or fall 10. And then along with the freshman enrollments, obviously, we have a transfer student strategy that varies a little bit year to year, but you can expect that on the Twin Cities campus. I don't, in my head, have the system-wide transfer numbers, but between 2,000 and 2,500 transfer students a year through the Twin Cities undergraduate population.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, just in simple numbers, 2007 to 2011 system-wide, you went from essentially 41,000 to 44,000 in
Mr.
round
Chairman,
numbers.
Members,
Mr.
Yes.
Carlson.
Thank you.
Moving along then, Mr. Chair, members, on tuition rates, we have provided some information on the structure, again, undergraduate versus graduate professional. One thing to keep in mind, tuition rates are actually tied to your enrollment status, so it is tied to what degree you are pursuing, whether you're full-time or part-time, whether you are resident or non-resident, rather than to specific courses that you're taking. So tuition is tied to your enrollment status. And we have a number of undergraduate rates, but on the Twin Cities campus, we have one single undergraduate rate for all of our colleges. This was done primarily so that we don't create barriers for people choosing particular majors across the colleges. We have one college, the Carlson School of Management, which currently has a $500 tuition surcharge. That is the only college currently charging a surcharge on top of the tuition rate. We have one single rate for all colleges in Duluth, the Morris campus and the Rochester campus, and you can see in the chart on the bottom that those are the same, slightly below the Twin Cities. And then the Crookston campus has also a single undergraduate rate, which is slightly below those other campuses. The graduate and professional tuition rates are set based on market considerations. They do differ by program. So the MBA rate, for example, will be different than the Master's in Public Health or different than the Master's in Education and so forth. We have examples on this chart, and we also provided to the committee, to the chair, the complete list of the board-approved tuition rates for FY13, and that would include all of the different graduate rates as well.
Ms. Townsend, this answers the differential tuition question then. You call it a tuition surcharge. Just so we have some continuity when Minskew comes up, I believe they call it differential tuition. So one of the questions that was asked of the systems is to tell us where they charge a different rate and why they charge a different rate for tuition and then the impact on the student. And this addresses that. Am I correct?
That's correct, Mr.
All right. Representative Norton.
Well, if I could just go a little bit further, Mr. Chair. And can you tell me a little bit, since right now you only have one surcharge, how do you determine why that particular college gets a surcharge? What's the rationale for it? And if some other school wanted to charge one, what would you use to determine whether that would be agreed upon?
Ms. Tonnens.
Mr. Chair, members, this started, first of all, just this year. This is the first year that the students in the Carlson School are paying the surcharge, and so it is a relatively new thing at the university. It was discussed around a number of different variables, but essentially the cost of providing instruction to students in the Carlson School is currently higher. They spend a significant amount of funding in areas of student support services, career services, and that type of thing. The cost is higher, and their salaries are higher. There's different things that go into that that generate the cost, but the cost is higher, and we have, in the cost emission analysis we did, you would see that. And then we look at other things like, for example, there isn't a lot of transfer activity at all between the other colleges in the Carlson School of Management, so it isn't the case that a student could enter in one college for 2 years and pay a lower rate and then transfer to Carlson and pay more, because there isn't that opportunity to transfer between the colleges. So those are some of the variables that went into the conversation.
Representative Dart.
Thank you. And so if we could just go a little bit further into that. I don't want to take up a lot of time here, but I want to try to understand this. So we have a new tuition surcharge. It seems to me, I guess I'm surprised that a business management program of all of them would cost more. It seems to me the sciences with the labs and that sort of thing would be the area where you would see a higher need to be able to rationalize. So can you just help me with this? And then what parameters, to kind of get back to the second part of my first question, how are you going to determine when the science department comes forward and say, we have expensive labs, we need to charge more, or are there other surcharges in labs?
Ms. Tonnens?
Okay, sure. Mr. Chair, members, a few parts to that. I don't know if we were surprised, but it was a result of our analysis that actually did show that the Carlson School of Management spending is higher for instruction than science and engineering, and there, for example. And there are a number of reasons for that. Some of it has to do with the actual cost factors of the school. So as I mentioned, the salaries that are paid to business faculty are just higher than they are those that are paid to English, for example. It's a market consideration in that instance. We also found higher student service spending in the Carlson School of Management. So for their career services, their advising, their international programming and so forth, it's a higher cost package of services than you would find at most of the other schools on campus. In terms of coming in and requesting additional surcharges, one of the things you will see when we get to the fee section here, we have a couple of slides on fees, and some of those differential costs are handled through course fees and other ways to get at some of that cost differential. In addition to, I mean, we learned that some of the program we do in science and engineering is a very efficient way to deliver instruction, and it is less than we anticipated in terms of cost.
Representative Norton, are you finished?
Well, it might take me a long time if we go down that road.
We have time.
Well, I just will be interested you say market-driven, and that concerns me a little bit. We have lots of quality people that teach in our college, so I guess I'll be interested to see what you mean by market-driven as opposed to seniority, length of time in service, the things that I would think would traditionally drive up salaries because someone's been there for 40 years as opposed to new staff with new turnover. And I'm also going to watch, and perhaps this will come later, but when you start talking about the difference between a tuition surcharge and lab fees and others, I mean, it's all money kind of coming out of students' pockets. And so as we watch that, we'll need to make certain that if it's being billed differently, that we're seeing that. It may not be as transparent when one's a surcharge and one's a lab fee and that sort of thing. So I'll leave that for now.
Representative Brainerd, I inadvertently missed you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this may reflect somewhat on Representative Norton's discussion, but I had this question in mind before she pursued her issues. It's regarding the graduate and professional tuition rates and the fact that you said they are market-driven or market considerations. And obviously, we see quite a dramatic difference in the range there. And I want to ask, if I looked at expenses in those programs, would I see a similar difference in the faculty salaries? Is that the primary driver, is faculty salaries? So would I see a similar a proportionate allocation in those areas, or are there other factors that drive those differences?
Ms. Tennant.
Mr. Chair, members, that is one variable, but there are others. If you think about dentistry, for example, the cost of the equipment and the materials, the gold and different things they have to purchase are very expensive. Some of them have a teaching model or a curriculum model that is a smaller ratio, a faculty to student ratio that's smaller, which is inherently more expensive. Some of them have equipment or space costs that are different than what you would find in a traditional undergraduate lecture room, for example. Those are just some of the other.
Representative Brenner.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. That does help, but I'm wondering if we would be able at some point to see some breakdown there, because I want to understand better where it is faculty salaries driving some of these differences. What are the criteria? What are you basing that on? You say market-driven. Is it, you know, is there a national standard? Is it your experience in the market when you bring in candidates to hire, who you can get? You know, because those are pretty critical decisions in understanding whether the costs are justified.
Yes.
So,
Ms. Tonnens.
Mr. Chair, members, it is many of the things you just discussed is true. And it will be, if we have an opportunity to do the presentation on cost of mission, those are exactly the type of issues that we deal with in that particular analysis.
Ms. Thompson, we intend the university to be given every opportunity it possibly wants to explain this. Representative Grudenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to the testifiers. You know, I was looking at slide 37 and just seeing, you know, how the tuition and the state funding have crossed there in 2011 and 12. You know, one of the things that questions I have is, you know, with the internet and distance learning and, you know, being able to complete your first 2 years, you've got not necessarily on campus. Have you seen where more and more students, you know, and one of the ways that I'm getting at is because of the amount of debt students are graduating with, but is there in your career counseling or your program working with students who have to borrow money to stay on campus, stressing the fact that they could complete some of these courses at a much lower cost over the internet or through distance learning or something like that in order to keep their cost for the first 2 years at a more reasonable rate?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, we don't have Vice Provost McMaster with us today. He would be better able to answer that question, but I'll give you a couple of examples that I know of. One, for example, on our Crookston campus does quite a bit of online learning, and I'm not sure if Chancellor Wood would say that it's entirely to keep, is that the only reason is not just to keep the cost down. He believes in the educational model as well. We have a very robust transfer curriculum, but we also believe that for a residential campus, there are benefits for certainly freshmen to be living on campus, and we do encourage students to do so.
Representative Grudenhagen.
Just a follow-up question to the testifiers. You know, just some incidental information that's come to my attention is that, you know, the ratio of, and I think I brought this up the other day already, the ratio of in-state tuition versus out-state tuition versus foreign students coming, we seem to have comparable to other institutions, we charge less to foreign students, many of whom pay cash, compared to other institutions, and also our non-residents. Is our ratio comparable to other similar institutions, or are we a little bit lower in the foreign and out-state resident tuition cost?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I would say it's fair to say that we are lower than most on the international rate. I also believe that the administration will be bringing a proposal to the board this spring to have that policy discussion.
Representative Poppy, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this group will be able to answer this, but the, we're talking about certainly the market considerations, and so it's what the market will bear and what the students will pay kind of get us to that point, if I'm understanding correctly. I'm just curious about the entrance expectations for students, so more of a student services model of how is the determination of the students that are coming to those different colleges, because certainly you have an excess of students who are applying. How do you determine the entrance expectations for those students, and how does that match with the outcome of those students and graduation and completion? So again, it might not be one that is a financial question so much as just the student services perspective.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, you're right. This is well outside the financial realm, and we try to be a little careful about that. But I will say that our admissions is a holistic review. Mm-hmm. So I always tell the story. When I went to the university in 1984, my application was a 3x5 postcard, and I put my class rank in and my ACT score. If it added up to over whatever that number was, you were in. That's not the way it happens anymore. So it's really a holistic review. That does include test scores. It does include high school transcripts and all the things you'd imagine. But there are certainly rooms for essays. I've seen the application. It's a 6-page sort of thing. They want to know about extracurriculars and so on and so forth. We obviously believe that that having a better prepared student gives the student the best chance for success to graduate. And I think we all know that we're much better off when those students do graduate in a timely manner.
Ms. Tomlinson,
yes,
sure.
If I could add, Mr. Chair, members, that isn't only true for the undergraduate programming. That is true for some of our graduate programming as well. And I don't want to step outside my knowledge base here, but I do know, for example, the College of Veterinary Medicine does a very holistic review of their applicants, and with that exact goal in mind, because they know what drives success of their students, so they do a very extensive holistic review for applicants.
Representative Pop.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. So perhaps, I don't know if you or others from the university would be able to show maybe again that 2006 to 2012 or back further, kind of the trajectory of completion, entrance, who those students are, and then to completion and the outcome of success. If the idea is, you know, we're getting students in, hopefully they're ready and prepared, but you may have additional costs to help them become better prepared. I just think that might be a picture of the student services side that I'd like to see. Thank you.
I've got a question on your graph on 39. Why is it the resident tuition and the non-resident tuition for the Twin Cities and Duluth vary by thousands of dollars, and then Morris, Crookston, and Rochester, they're the same?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Carlson.
Members, the equalization of the resident and non-resident rates on both the Crookston and Morris campus was a deliberate decision maybe 8 years ago, and that was very much a strategic, market-driven decision on the university's part for our two western Minnesota campuses as we looked at demographic trends and enrollment patterns in the early part of the last decade. Both those campuses were losing enrollments, and not by a small amount, and that was clearly a pricing decision. When Rochester opened up at the undergraduate level to establish their enrollment base, they chose the same model.
So this was not made at the campus level, it was made at the administrative level by the president or the
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Those discussions are held between the campuses and the academic leaders and the president on the Twin Cities campus. Those aren't made in a manner that's separate from or without the knowledge of the campus. This is a collaborative budget model and discussion.
All right, that collaborative hasn't quite been presented to us yet, but I'm sure it will be as to how exactly these budgets are put together. But I want to go back to the term market-driven for a second. You've used it several times. I'm going back to the testimony of last week. I hope market-driven doesn't mean we did it because we could, that there's a quantitative reason for doing this and a programmatic reason for doing it that enhances the program at the university and yet can be sustained by the tuition that's being charged. Because market-driven is a bit vague, particularly when market-driven would come out of the Carlson School where you have differential tuition.
Mr. Chairman, I concur with your statements. When the term market-driven was used in the example of the differential or the tuition surcharge at the Carlson School, what was meant by that was the fact that the salaries paid the faculty tend to be higher and more market-driven than the salaries for someone in CLA or in the English department. That's what it was meant. And that simply is what occurs when you go out to hire faculty. Every one of the schools tends to have a different market profile for faculty.
Well, my observation would be tend to be is sort of a loose definition. And I'm hoping you can show us exactly what that means by salaries and program. And this is the discussion we had in my office prior to these hearings. And I'm hoping, again, that we can get down to an example of what you mean by tend to be higher, which salaries, where and when and how. So,
Mr. Chairman, we can show you the salaries of the faculty in the Carlson School versus plenty of ways. We can get that for you.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, again, when you say market-driven, are you comparing that to other Big Ten schools, other public institutions, private institutions, other jobs that these folks may have gotten in other sectors, whether that be private industry, public industry?
Mr. Chairman, members, it would tend to be peer comparisons, similar research institutions in the country, Big Ten, or just bear in mind what it takes in the case of a law school professor to get someone who's also a practicing attorney to teach a class and give up time and be an adjunct faculty member. So it's local markets as well as national and in some cases international markets if you start to get into the scientist medical research arena.
Representative Lee.
Thank you.
All right, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm just going to turn now to my colleague Lincoln Paulson to talk a little bit about another part of this equation, because what you see here, of course, is the sticker price. But what's really important at the University of Minnesota to pay attention to now is how much grant and aid, loans, et cetera, the financial aid that's provided students. We didn't come today in this presentation to show everything we have about that, give you a flavor, but you do need to realize that net price is a very important ingredient in understanding what students actually pay to attend the University of Minnesota and what their family income is. And I know you'll be into that discussion as well with the governor's proposal on the state grant program. So with that, I'll turn to my colleague.
Representative Winkler has a question before you start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, you may have covered this. Your slide 39, tuition rates, I assume that is straight tuition. And maybe I've missed it in the presentation, but I don't see numbers here on student fees.
Mr. Chairman, members, total
cost of
attendance. This is the, you're correct, these are just the published tuition rates. There are tuition and fee numbers. So, for example, that Twin Cities undergraduate at $12,060, if you look at tuition and required fees, now again, we'll get into the differential fees by college in a moment, that number would be $13,524.
So,
but and that, of course, doesn't include room and board or books or supplies or transportation or personal and miscellaneous charges. If you throw all of that in, you would have a full cost there, what one might call the cost of attendance, of $24,718.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, so if I got your numbers correct, it looks like it's at roughly $1,500 in fees for an undergraduate at the Twin Cities campus.
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's correct.
And
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, can you give us just a top-level breakdown of what those fees are? And I gather that's average rather as opposed to based
Mr.
on...
Mr. Chairman, we can do that and get into a little bit of explaining what's in that number in a couple of slides here.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, I skipped ahead and looked at that, and I didn't see any. It's all words. I didn't see any numbers in there. But I,
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
we can certainly break that down for you and bring that to you in the Q&A we'll give you.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, I'm going to remind you again. I appreciate the explanation, but with the explanation, we would also like quantitative numbers. This is going to be when we get done about numbers. And our numbers are going to be pretty tough here this session, just like in previous sessions. So,
Mr. Chairman, members, it's always difficult in these presentations. I've seen numbers on darn near every slide we've given you. So if you have questions about numbers, we'll get them to you as quick as we can. We're good to go on that.
Okay. Mr. Fitzgerald, I'm hoping we're going to have a more focused approach on numbers. But I'm going to get to that at the end of the hearing. Proceed. Representative Winkler, are you finished? I didn't. You're done. All right. I don't think I have any more questions, so go ahead. Mr. Pauls.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm just going to do two quick slides on financial aid. You'll obviously have a longer discussion with the Office of Higher Education. But slide 40 shows for degree-seeking undergraduates last year some of the flavors of total financial support that we provide undergraduates. I'll just take you along the rows, since obviously the columns are our campuses. So gift aid in this slide is all types of federal, state, and institutional aid that does not have to be repaid by the student. So that's Pell Grants, that's Minnesota State Grants, and it's also institutional aid provided by the university primarily for undergraduates in the form of our Promise Scholarship, which is targeted at low and middle income students, and we'll show you the effect of that in a second. We do a very modest amount of waivers. Employment continues to be important to many of our undergraduate students, especially those that live on campus. And the loan number there is both student direct student loans as well as PLUS or parent loans. Remember that financial aid for students does try to cover the entire cost of attendance, not just tuition and fees. And on the following slide, this is a little, maybe a little busy, I apologize, but I think there's an important point here as you think about financial aid, especially gift aid. So across the x-axis there are several Minnesota institutions, both public and private. And the bars, this is U.S. Department of Education data, show the net price by various family income levels. So, for example, for each school, the purple bar represents families between $0 and $30,000 AIG, what their net price is for each institution. So net price is published cost of attendance minus federal grants, state grants, local grants, and institutional grants and scholarships. So as you look at that, one thing you might notice is that for amongst these schools, for income ranges between $0 and $75,000, the University of Minnesota is delivering the lowest net price on this chart. And you can see the wide variation in other institutions. And much of that has to do with the institutional commitment, both in our Promise program, but also several years of pretty hard fundraising by both President Brunix and President Kaler around scholarships and financial aid.
And Mr. Chairman, just to underscore that, as you know, and in the governor's recommendation this year, He increased the tuition cap, which had been frozen by the state since 2000.
I don't remember either.
Six, seven, in there, been frozen for many, many years. Despite that freeze, the university, through the Promise Scholarship that was started by President Brunix in the early part of the decade, has still made sure that college was affordable for those lower-income students and middle-income students. And I think that's in part reflective on this chart as to what the institution's done, still to make education as affordable as possible for its students.
Questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 40, I guess it's Mr. Carlson. I'm trying to simplify so I understand how these things work a little better. In the Twin Cities column, you have gift aid, waivers, employment, and loans. And then you have your note at the bottom saying that total institution financial aid expenditures was $210 million. So I guess if I go over to that total on the bottom right-hand corner, that $509 million, of that $509, $210 comes from university sources. Is that what that means?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I looked at that note all last week as I saw these slides, and I finally had to go ask what it meant myself, so I'm glad you asked. The big difference there is the note is for gift aid for all student levels. So that $210.5 million,
oh, I see,
gift aid and waivers, is the amount of university aid to all students in the given year.
And this is just undergraduate.
And this is just undergraduate, and the gift aid represents money from both the federal and state government as well as the institution.
Representative Wick. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, what the number that I'm most interested in is if you look at the gift aid, what percentage of that comes from public sources?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
members,
Paulson.
I'm certain we do have that number, but I believe we're going to have to get that for you because in my notes I'm looking quickly. I apologize.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, you don't need to have a number off the top of your head in that case, but I am interested in how much of these financial support comes from either federal or state public taxpayer sources or student loans. Another way I look at that is how much of the total cost of attendance is offloaded to other private and public sources. And I would not put employment or waivers in that. I guess waivers are costs of the university, so that would be taken out. But, you know, how much is the federal financial aid system and private student debt financing total university education?
Carlson?
See what we can do.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, we can provide that that level of detail to you.
Okay, proceed.
I'll turn to my colleague on student fees.
Ms. Donaldson, that must be you.
Mr. Chair, members, we have two slides that talk about, again, narratively about the fees that are in Regents policy. This does not include the room and board fees, but fees charged to students for a variety of things. Again, the entire list of the current year FY13 board-approved fees in all of these categories was provided to the chair and the committee rather than have them here on the slide. But we have four different categories, we would say, of fees that are governed by two different Regents policies. The first one is the Regents policy on student services fees. This is a category of fees for student service-oriented departments and organizations, and they do vary by campus, and we'll talk a little bit about the process for how those are set on the next slide, but you do see examples there. This would be rec sports and the newspapers and student groups that come in and request funding from that process. The other three categories are in the Regents' policy on tuition and fees. We have administrative slash miscellaneous fees. Examples here are, some of them are for to incent behavior or to recognize a particular benefit to a student. So we have application fees, the stadium fee, transportation fees. This is where you're going to have locker rental fees, breakage fees, that type of thing. We have course fees that are unique, that try to recognize the unique costs for a particular course. Generally speaking, they are in three major areas. Field trips, so transportation for field trips is a common course fee. Consumable materials, things that are used up during the term for a particular course. This would often be in the science classes or art, for example. And then we have some that are based on services provided. So if we, for example, hire a model for an art class and we have to pay the model. These are, again, very unique costs to a particular course. And then we have academic fees, more commonly called collegiate fees or campus fees. They are charged at the college or campus level, not at the course level. And they are designed to recover costs of student-focused services. So we have some colleges that have a collegiate fee that really focus a lot on maybe on their computer labs or their career services, their orientation activities, different things that are specific to students, not for the costs of instruction in the classroom. The process for these...
Ms. Tonneson, stay here for a second.
Sure.
How would we know these fees, how long standing have these fee types been? Have they been around for 10 years, 20 years, 100 years? How long?
Mr. Chair, members, I can tell you that the first three, the student services fees, the administrative miscellaneous, and the course fees, certainly have been around a very long time, longer than we have been at the university. The academic fees, probably in the early 90s, I would say, does that sound about right, began, and actually they evolved out of that growth of technology and the use of technology in the colleges.
So, and that would be an area where, how do we know how much these fees have grown over the last, say, 10 years? Because technology has more and more dominated what students are going to do for accessing courses, registering, even taking courses, even though it may not be online. Much of the materials they may get online. So, how do we know the increases in these fees over the last, let's just say, 6 years ago?
Mr. Chair, members, we can provide that information in terms of the collegiate fee and by college. We have it by year, by college.
Right. I would like it, but now that you're the expert, how much would you say these have increased?
Mr. Chair, members, some of them, very surprisingly, very little. I mean, we have some that have probably been about, if we're talking about the collegiate fees, let's say it's $100 a semester, and they have been that way for 7 years. We have some that have grown. Some that have started, they vary significantly. So you might have one that started at $300 and is now $500, but that happened over a period of 6 to 8 years.
Ms. Thompson, since you're the expert, can you give me one example of a fee that has grown substantially over that time period, a real example of a fee?
Has grown substantially.
And if you can't, I put you on the spot, but if you can come back to us, because this is an area where it's difficult to ascertain the cost and the fees, because these tend to be somewhat hidden. And I'd like to have a look at how much the students have been feed and by what. These may be long-standing fees, but certainly technology isn't a long-standing fee.
Mr. Chair, we can do this in a couple of different ways. We can provide you the information. Where I'm struggling is I don't remember what they were 6 years ago, so
right.
We can do it a couple of different ways. We actually, as part of our cost of attendance information we provide to the board, we include averages, and that one way we can show you is how that has changed over time, in that the average, for example, on the Twin Cities campus or Crookston from 6 years ago to today. Another way we can do it is actually try to find some that have changed to provide you specific examples.
So the Board of Regents has seen these fees, and they've seen the fee increases, and they voted on the fee increases.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fitzenwright.
Members of the committee, we provided the committee with a copy of the fee document that's included in the some almost 100-page budget that goes to the Board of Regents. They vote on every one of these fees.
And now, Mr. Fitzenwright, I want it presented in this format to the committee by you. And that's what I'm asking for. When we see one slide on fees, and it's a... Mr. Fitzenwright.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, let's take course fees, for example. There are... How many would you guess?
Hundreds.
Hundreds of course fees. So we provided the committee with one copy. We'll provide one to every one of you if you'd like it, but we weren't killing trees. We can do it. There are hundreds of course fees. Let me comment on course fees. Course fees raise maybe $6 million in a given year. Course fees come and go. Course fees have not been a place where people have intentionally run the course fees up to offset or hide or disguise tuition increases. We are going to get to the process slide in a minute. Course fees, they come and go. As he explained, we can show the total revenue growth in course fees, but because the course fees come and go, you'd be looking at literally thousands of changes in course fees that didn't exist one year and do exist the next year. Some drop off because the course goes away. On the academic fees, we can give you the actual academic fee. There aren't that many of them, and we can show the fee growth and the revenue to you. There'll be many of those, though, as many.
There's maybe 15 to 20.
Yeah.
Mr. Fitzenwriter, when you're asked to provide information, I hope we're not going to have as an answer for not giving the details, killing trees. In this case, this legislature needs the information. Now, I would like you to present it to us in a fashion that we've discussed this in three meetings in my office alone. So there has to be more than one slide on how these things exist, the amount they exist at, and whether or not they have increased disproportionately over the same period of time as tuition and other things. So I don't want the answer killing trees. I want the information. Mr. Fitzenwriter.
Mr. Chairman, if we move on to the process slide here so that the committee understands how the decisions on these fees are made, I think that would be helpful here.
Mr. Chair, members, the student services fee category is a category of fees where student groups or student-focused organizations at the university, like Rec Sports, for example, bring their fee request, a formal fee request, to a committee. And the committee is a majority student, okay, and a few staff, but the majority of the committee is students. And that committee reviews all of the requests from these organizations and makes a recommendation to the leadership of the university of which ones should be approved and what that total student services fee should be. And this is done by campus. It's done unique on each campus. And then it is presented to the board, the leadership and the president recommend to the board the level of the student service fee every year, and it's included in the budget that the board sees and approves.
And Ms. Tonneson, do the student groups involved, and I think I asked this question before, but I'm going to repeat it, do they actually get to vote as a student group on these fees, or is it just a here's the fee and we want input? How does that exactly work?
Mr. Chair, members, the student groups themselves are the ones who propose funding levels for their organization, for their group. And they bring it as a proposal to a committee. And the committee votes on whether or not, what level of funding should be approved for that particular group. So if you have Rec Sports or the Minnesota Daily Newspaper, for example, they would bring their funding request to this committee. The committee votes, which is a majority of, it's a student-based committee. And they would vote on whether or not to approve or deny or approve at a different level the amount of funding that was proposed. And then that vote dictates what goes to the leadership and to the board for approval.
Does the failure of an increase in those fees ever impact the viability of that particular group's existence?
I would imagine, Mr. Chair, members, I believe that that must be true, yes.
That must be true, so you wouldn't have an entity that's telling the students, if you don't request a fee increase, you won't exist.
Don't request a fee increase. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, could you repeat
that? I'm saying, is there an entity on campus, it may be administrative, that would say if you don't request a fee increase, this particular activity will cease to exist? Think on that one. Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought maybe I'd learn this from reviewing this slide more closely. The committee that you talked about that makes the that votes on the group's requests, I guess, how is that committee formed?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Calls.
Mr. Chairman, members, actually, it takes a better part of fall semester to constitute that committee. Both the Minnesota Student Association, the undergraduate governance, and our graduate student governance goes through processes within within their own organizations to forward nominees and eventually elect members to the Student Services Fees Committee every year. So what's one of their first orders of business as they organize in the fall is student government actually puts that committee together. The committee, once formed, elects its own chair, must be a student, and we usually have that committee in place hopefully before the end of fall semester, but it's usually not much before.
Representative Wink.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, did the student, the undergraduate and graduate student associations, did they receive money from the fees as well?
Paulson.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, they do.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, this is beginning to remind me of the Legacy Committee, again, where all the organizations that benefit from the funding got together and decided that the funding should go up, surprisingly, and they put it on the ballot and they succeeded, and now they all get together and decide how the funding gets spent. And so I guess I wonder, are the student associations all sort of getting together deciding that they all want more money in order to recommend higher fees, or is there, you know, do they have a campaign in which somebody says, let's cut these fees and reduce, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse in our student organizations or something? I mean, are there Republicans, you know, who do this?
Mr. Calls.
Mr. Chairman, members, I have actually served as a staff member on the Student Services Fee Committee. I can assure you there are both Democrats and Republicans on these committees. I've probably oversimplified that a little bit. The student government's actually taking applications from the student body, and don't quote me on this, but I think there is a limit to the number of people within student government that can serve on the Student Services Fees Committee. So the student government is actually receiving the applications from the student community in order to populate these various committees. Does that help?
Representative Winkler. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Taking a look at the student service fees and the administrative fees, do they vary by student? Like, for example, one student will pay a different fee based on certain needs and services, or is that uniform for all students?
Mr. Chair, members, the student services fee, there is a single fee per campus. So that first group, each campus has a single fee that is charged to all students that are charged the fee. That's essentially all of the students. The second category, the administrative miscellaneous course and academic fees, those vary by student almost completely. So the process for that, if I can go through that real quick, and maybe that will help answer the question a little bit. But in this category, this is where the Department of Art, for example, will request a fee for the next year up through the budget process. So they propose a fee, and they justify it based on cost, generally what it is for, and its consistency with board policy and with our operating guidelines for that fee. And if it meets all of the qualifications and makes it up through the process, we review it in our office, goes up through the president, and gets included in the budget again that goes to the board. But this is, so for that particular example, if the art department was requesting a fee for some kind of metal that they use in an art class, for example, that's charged only to the students who take that class. So the course fee is based on course designator for the class you take. If it's an administrative fee, depends again, if you want to rent a locker, you pay it. If you don't, you don't. If you order a transcript, you pay the fee. If you don't, you don't. So they really vary a great deal. The collegiate fees, the academic slash collegiate or campus fees, those are going to vary by college or campus, but they are charged to all the students enrolled in that particular college or campus. There are exceptions. Sometimes, for example, the College of Veterinary Medicine has exempted their graduate students. They charge the professional students, but not the graduate students. So it varies a little bit, but generally it's the students that are enrolled in the course, or I'm sorry, the college.
Representative Lee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tonneson. Mr. Chair, and also Ms. Tonneson, do you know, between the different campuses, comparing, you know, Minnesota, Duluth, Crookston, the greater Minnesota, to the Twin Cities campus, would you be able to put a degree or a number on how those different fees vary between the two campuses? And then also, I was kind of wondering if you had a rough average, whether it be for greater Minnesota campuses or the U of M, what the average fees in total would be for a student, or, for example, the course fees, what that average would be for a specific course.
Ms. Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, members, I can tell you the student services fee by campus right now. I have that here if you're interested in that. This is now per semester, which is how it gets approved by the board, so just double it for a full-time student. But for Crookston for the current year, it's $212.75. For Duluth, it's $296.27. For Morris, it's $324.50. For Rochester, it's $168. And for the Twin Cities, it's $368.28. That's for that first category of student services fees. So on the Twin Cities campus, for example, it's a little bit less than half of what that $1,500 average fee would be. The other categories in terms of by campus, I don't have right here an average for all of the course fees. They really vary significantly. We might have some that are $15 for a course, and we might have some that are $100. We also have some course fees that are for international travel, so it's also portion of the international costs go through as a course fee, which would be quite a bit more than that. It would be in the hundreds of dollars, if not $1,000, depending on what the particular thing is. So the course fees are going to vary significantly. The collegiate or campus fees, I can't do that really quickly. It's in the materials here, but I'd have to look on multiple pages. We can get that to you in terms of the collegiate or campus fee.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not necessarily against the fees that you cite, but again, and maybe you already said you're going to provide this, but I would like to see what the change has been over the last 10, 15 years so we can have some gauge the difference that has occurred over the last period of time. So that's what I'm looking for.
Ms. Tonneson, I'm going to go back a second to the students. Are any of these fees directly tied to an amenity? And the students are told, if you don't support the fee, you won't get the amenity. Then the university or the campus uses it to promote getting more students, which I don't really necessarily have a problem with. But the students then are bearing the cost, or the majority of the cost, or whatever the thing is. Is that done on a regular basis, and to what extent? And since there's been national press and state press on the cost of bearing these types of things, how extensive is it? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, so let's take a recreational sports fee, which is in the press in lots of places. We are opening a expansion to our rec center on the Twin Cities campus. That will increase the student services fee. That operating cost is discussed by the students. The project itself will nearly double the amount of space, and members will say, might say, well, do you really need it? Well, we made the rec sports people come through and not only benchmark and go to market, but such as it was, and we didn't really take that argument very seriously, but they would show multiple hours of peak use where students weren't getting the service that they felt they deserved. We said, well, here's a trade-off, students. We can add 10,000 square feet, 50,000 square feet. This is what it sort of means in terms of access to fitness equipment, access to exercise courses, so on and so forth. So we have that discussion. Yes, if they didn't fund it, then they would not have that amenity.
And Mr. Carlson, was there any discussion of the long-term acceptance of the paying of this by each individual student and how over the long term this added to their college debt? Or
Mr. Chairman, I think they take that discussion quite seriously, actually.
Mr. Carlson, I'm wondering if they do. I'm concerned that when you're dealing with a student who may be paying this off on a credit card, that I wonder if they do. And this goes back to Representative Poppy's question on counseling. I wonder how much counseling they actually get when they're offered something at that age that they want and they can pay for with what looks like a relatively small fee. I'll ask one more question. Are any of these, is there an attempt to offset any of these with private money? That when you're going to do that type of an amenity, that you go to, and the U is usually excellent at this, generating private money to offset the cost. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Mr. Chairman, just by way of example, continuing the rec sports discussion on the Twin Cities campus, they recently added, a fundraiser to the rec sports with the foundation in hopes of going out and raising some money for bricks and mortar and operation. That wasn't something they were doing 2, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and they're now putting an emphasis on that because they think they have that opportunity. I want to just underscore one other thing, that in these sort of step increases in student fees, when we did the rec center fee, for example, the capital enhancement fee, or the TCF Bank Stadium fee that was put on students, one of the things that we try to do, and while this is counterintuitive to what you mentioned a minute ago, is we try to set those fees up so that the students, you know, you build a rec center, it takes a few years to build it and open it. We're not laying that rec center cost on students that are going to graduate in 2 years, so we step it in, the fee in, so that there's the benefit to the students. They aren't paying for something they don't benefit from. We're very conscious of that. Now, that may encourage them, because the students voting on it, you are correct, aren't thinking about that fee in terms of the cost of attendance, but we're at least trying to make sure that the students that will pay that fee will have the opportunity to actually use the facility, not ones who will graduate.
All right. Rep. Sam Durrell, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, I move that the minutes of January 30th.
Representative Durrell moves the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We will be revisiting this on Wednesday, and I know you have a number of questions that members have asked you to answer, and I would hope that you can get them to us. And if you can get them to all of the members, despite what it might take, let's get the information to all of the members. Meeting is adjourned.